histories of wildlife and thoughts on animals, a roundtable discussion with members from the Toronto Environmental History Network, and I speak with the co-producers of a new Environmental Studies podcast series. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 27 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Last year, in an effort to foster conversation and discussion among scholars, the journal Environmental History published a special forum of short essays on wildlife histories and the legacy of Peter Matheson's 1959 book, Wildlife in America. 11 scholars published short articles in which they discussed the impact of wildlife in America and future directions for environmental historians who study the history of wild animals and the idea of wildlife. I recently sat down for a conversation with three members of the Toronto Environmental History Network to discuss this thought-provoking forum.
My name is Ben Bradley. I'm a very long-term doctoral candidate at Queen's University. And I've done a lot of writing about the history of parks, and some of that has involved parks managers displaying animals for the amusement of motorists, getting animals to hang around places where people park, getting animals to stay in ponds that people drive past, to have like a natural corridor. And with working on that and catching talks by people like Sean, I want to, in the future, do some more work on animals as roadside amusements, as that being a way that people learned about animals. So I'm sort of a newbie to the animal history scene, the wildlife history scene, but it's been a lot of fun to read these.
I'm Andrew Watson. I'm a PhD candidate at York University, and I must admit my work doesn't have much to do with wildlife, but I'm doing my project on sustainability and the history in Muskoka in Central Ontario.
I'm Jennifer Bedell. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Guelph. I'm currently working on a project on beekeeping in Ontario and New York State and looking at connections with land use change in suburban areas.
Maybe just before we start talking about the actual forum on wildlife, one of you can tell listeners a little bit about the Toronto Environmental History Network and what this group is.
Sure. I guess we've been operating for about 4 years. Is that about right?
Yeah.
We realized that we had this critical mass of environmental historians in Toronto and felt like we should get together more frequently. So it's a fluctuating group of 8 to 12 to occasionally more of environmental historians working on issues in Canada and beyond, people from looking at British environmental history too. So,
excellent.
We've been meeting about 8 times in the academic year.
Yeah.
And then over the last year, we were doing some summer barbecues with whomever's in town coming out for a more casual meeting or watching a movie or something like that.
And so the group includes faculty, graduate students, postdocs.
Yeah, definitely.
So any listeners out there in the Toronto area who are interested in participating in the Toronto Environmental History Network, you can find out more information about the group from the NICHE website, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So why don't we begin then? I wanted to ask you guys what you thought of the articles in this forum on wildlife in America. Which did you find the most interesting or the most provocative or thought-provoking or challenging?
I really liked the Benson, Barrow, and Alagona articles. I think mostly because I like the focus they put on looking more at habitat and ecosystems, sort of the wider parameters that we understand wildlife in, rather than just the wildlife in particular. And I think they really raised a few interesting questions about why we latch on to wildlife versus the systems in general. So I enjoyed those three, I think.
Well, the one for me that was most thought-provoking was actually the shortest of the bunch, the article by Benson about wildlife as distinct from the term wildlife.
So from one word, wildlife, and two words, wildlife.
Yeah. And that tied it in to a broader social and cultural history, especially of North America for me. And that really drove how I thought about some of the other articles.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me, I really enjoyed all of the articles in this forum, but I guess most provocative was John Coleman's piece, Killed Him a Bear, about Davy Crockett, mm-hmm. and bringing in issues of marginality, of ways of connecting animal with human bodies. Really a provocative piece, especially when we consider contemporary figures like Sarah Palin, to shed some light on her popularity for me. I found I wanted more out of many of these articles, and of course the length of them precluded that, but I'd love to see more from John Coleman. Don Beeler's piece on rats and public health,
yeah.
I thought really broadened the idea of wildlife. So we're not just thinking about wilderness out there, but wildlife in cities, wildlife in our everyday lives.
And also Lisa Wadowitz's on fish and whether mm-hmm. or not fish are wildlife.
Yeah. Absolutely. Finally, Jennifer Adams Martin's piece on sharks. I thought brought up in kind of problematic ways for me issues of animal agency, and I'd mm-hmm. like to talk about that further. Yeah.
Well, why don't we start there then, actually, because you're right, that final article in the forum by Jennifer Adams Martin on sharks probably most directly addressed this question of animals and agency and how we write about wildlife as historians. So maybe we can open it up to a discussion then about how you thought these articles dealt with that issue.
Well, I think the concept of wildlife in general tends to be a passive one, that it's about humans more than it actually is about wildlife. And the Martin's argument about sharks having some agency, about mm-hmm. being able to make choices to a certain extent. I don't know if choice is even the right word for it, but be able to affect change regardless of whether or not humans can even understand it or comprehend it or reason, mm-hmm. rationalize what they're doing.
Even when thinking about rats in cities, right, that kind of touches on this issue of the kind of stories that we can tell about past animals as actors that behave in ways that go beyond human control.
I guess for me, the problem was the suggestion that we can somehow write animal histories mm-hmm. In thinking about the Adams Martin article. Certainly there's a sense of animals as historical actors, as agents of change in largely human stories of relationships with wildlife. But I really wondered how far we can push that, what evidence we could work with, how can we construct these narratives? So those mm-hmm. were.
I wonder whether this shark attack file that she describes,
which sounded like a really great set of sources.
That's what I was wondering, if this was steering her interest in the agency question. Mm-hmm. If she was maybe taking this thing apart to get a sense of how sharks have behaved over more than 50 years that these files go back, that this could be read as, instead of just guessing about an animal or making a generalization, here's a nice long-term source that could really let a historian come up with some generalizations about how an animal's behavior have chosen to behave when interacting with humans.
I guess, but there's that, you know, we're trespassing into animal behavior and the terrain of scientists, which I think, you know, historians need to push up against and engage with. But the whole point she brings up about there was no control, when did sharks not attack? How can we make larger generalizations? Was it all about pink diving shorts? I thought she addressed those questions, or at least raised them as problems in interesting ways in this piece. But it still left me with the question. She talked about what was the term she used as sharks moving through their own life histories or navigating their own life history. And I see that fundamental divide between to attack or not to attack, but how can we carve a larger life history out of that?
Well, and it seems like she's trying to predict what animals are going to do or give them some sort of like a human agency that they would do things for the same reasons that humans would, that we can predict what animals are going to do, almost in a way of that if we can predict, then we can understand and control them. Mm-hmm. And wildlife almost always, when it's raised in a lot of these articles, is about that issue of control. And so if you run into something like sharks, why do they attack? Why don't they attack? And you're still trying to compartmentalize wildlife as some sort of predictable or controllable part of nature when it's antithetical to the idea of wildlife, I think.
One thing that I found intriguing from that article is her suggestion that this set of sources can offer historians a way to write about wild animals and their history, at least over this 50-year period, in which animals aren't victims in the narrative. But I wanted to ask you guys whether you thought that environmental historians should be trying to avoid a declensionist narrative when writing about wildlife history.
When animals fight back.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, right? When sharks bite back.
Some of the animals that are chosen in these articles, sharks, she starts her little piece off with a guy getting eaten, and the bears. It's easy to have an animals fight back narrative when you're dealing with something big and toothed and clawed. But to extend that, say, to rats or birds or salmon or bugs, gets a lot more tricky.
But isn't it even kind of artificial to say that the sharks are showing a different narrative, that they bite back, that they have agency because they can kill humans and they prey on humans? But isn't there another narrative that's been obscured by that, which is that a lot of these sharks are endangered animals, that their habitat is being destroyed, that they can kill as many humans as they want, but ultimately industrial activity of human beings is going to kill them first?
On the subject of declensionist narratives, I thought, you know, the fundamental story here is one of decline. We can't avoid that. But some of these articles are pushing us to move beyond ideas of wildlife as charismatic species, as thinking about wildlife beyond wilderness. And there we can find some other stories. We can look to Beeler's story about rats. We can, Sandlos and Wiersma suggest that some populations have actually increased post-contact. So there's a complexity there that we can probe perhaps to make ourselves feel a little bit better. you can't get away fundamentally, I don't think, from an overall story of decline. It's difficult to...
Well, that's what it's about.
Qualifying it or complicating it rather than... what was the term you used, Sean? Did you say, like, disrupting these
things? Yeah, yeah.
But to qualify or try to make them more... rather than a straight line down, a line that has jogs and loops backward and things like that.
But yeah. Declensionist for what? The wildlife, or declensionist for humans, human society, and because I think we can look at it in terms of things getting definitely worse for wildlife. But if you look at a lot of other initiatives to try and like understand the way humans can live in ecosystems and in our own habitat in more sustainable ways, those don't necessarily. There maybe things are getting better in terms of sustainability, thinking about energy use, thinking about land use and resources, whereas wildlife tends to, in this story, keep getting worse and worse. So I don't know whether the declensionist narrative lines up with the way we want to think about environmental history overall, or just the fate of wild animals.
Are we talking about purely numbers, population numbers? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that's another issue about thinking about decline. One thing I noticed, there's a few suggestions in these pieces about invasive species, the role of invasive species. And I think that's another thing that we need to investigate a bit more, is our tendency to want to attach certain words to these as either aliens or exotics, rather than particularly adaptive, successful species. So there's that question too. And those stories aren't certainly all of decline. We see explosive population growth in some, you know, Great Lakes predator species. So.
Well, and Beeler's article shows that too, right? She talks about synanthropes, animals that thrive in industrial human settings. So I think maybe in that sense, those kinds of histories disrupt declensionist narratives of wildlife. Mm-hmm.
And if we talk about declensionist narratives, is the assumption that to combat that, are we talking about nature returning to some primordial, pre-human kind of setting where the declension is not always things getting worse for wildlife, but we want to return to when wildlife had it good? I don't know whether we want to make histories that are trying to return to some previous time. It's a change is always in the forward direction. It's not really about things getting worse and then all of a sudden they can get better because that's what they used to be.
One thing I liked returning to the Adams Martin article was this idea of elusiveness of the limits of our knowledge. And I thought that's something so important to recognize and explore a bit is we can't know what's going on inside an animal's head. And and again, that comes back to that limits of writing animal histories that I think is, you know, all of the authors in this series suggest that to some degree, but I think it's a big fundamental thing about writing wildlife history.
That's something that I've thought about a couple times, again, as a dabbler in this field, is how much things like instinct, animal instinct, is historical on an evolutionary scale, on tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, how millions of years. Humans have instincts that when faced with a situation, will behave a certain way, you know, like you'll put your arms up around your head, or an infant will behave in certain ways. Are animals' instincts, in a sense, historical in and of themselves? We're saying we don't know that an animal is its thought process or is an agent, but as a species, it has certain inherent characteristics.
Are wildlife trapped in time? That they don't demonstrate change the way maybe domesticated animals do, or humans certainly have,
and
that they we expect them to behave the same way they did in the 17th century that they do in the 21st century?
We expect them to behave as historical actors the same way we think of ourselves as behaving as historical actors, when in fact they might be historical actors and agents on a much longer time scale than we do.
Whereas Beeler's article really demonstrates that wildlife has the capacity to change based on the settings changing, the way humans treat the animals, the habitat we create for them or remove from them.
And Algoma, too, talking about habitat and how our best efforts to restore habitats for certain species have sometimes backfired, and how this idea of animal instinct and predictable animal behavior is sometimes blows up in our face, I guess, in that animals might shift towards degraded habitats and adapt, and our ability, like you say, that instinct is historical, that it changes over time, perhaps.
You might be seeing that with polar bears even today. You read stories now and then about the polar bears are more on land. Their ice is disappearing. We're going to see animals. Well, potentially we might see animals that have been programmed a certain way through evolution to have certain instincts.
A scientist might, I guess, ask us to distinguish between instinct and behavior. I'm not sure. Like, perhaps behavior shifts and instincts remain more constant. I don't know.
So one thing that I thought was provocative from this collection of articles was the first article by John Sanlas and Yolanda Wiersma that suggests that one of the difficulties that historians have had and contemporary wildlife activists have had is a problem of historical sources and inaccuracies and flat out inaccuracies of estimates of animal populations in historical sources that have been used uncritically. So do you agree with this statement that Sanlas and Wiersma make, that these historical sources have been uncritically accepted as statements of fact?
I thought this was a really interesting collaboration between an ecologist and a historian in looking at things that have been by all accounts, sort of taken for granted. Mm-hmm. I haven't explored this question mm-hmm. very much, but in reading this article, it became very clear that how this could happen, how this could be repeated through subsequent and continuous publications, these figures kind of repeated uncritically.
Yeah. Like, they used the example of Ernest Thompson Seton's wildlife population estimates, where he based it on acreage and carrying capacity for horses and assumed that, for example, bison would be comparable to horses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought they raised some really good points about this difficulty of estimating historical populations and this idea of historical range of variability that you were mm-hmm. talking about, that you know, populations have always fluctuated based on a complex range of factors, and it's difficult to pinpoint in any place in time what was a baseline.
So I mean, it's extremely important to sort of try and combine the ecology sciences together with historic inquiry. But
I think that was really the point of that article.
Yeah.
I thought it underlines a great significance for historical research that historians exercise the skills of critically analyzing historical sources. And so we offer that kind of skill to explain why Ernest Thompson Seton's projections of wildlife populations might have been inaccurate. And I encountered a similar thing in my own research on storms in Stanley Park, that following the storms in 2006 and 2007, foresters for the park board were making assumptions about historical storms in the 60s and in the 30s based on statements of estimates of numbers of downed trees. But when I did the research on those storms, those estimates are guesstimates at best. They were published in newspapers within hours after the storm of how many trees were toppled in Stanley Park. Well, how did the reporter come up with that number? Did he go and do an estimation by walking through the forest, or was he up in a helicopter observing damage to acreage in the park? Well, no.
We're just using exciting prose.
Oh, it was a guess at best, I think. I think this is a problem that, for wildlife, that makes a lot of sense, and historians can make a pretty substantial contribution to contemporary research on wildlife populations.
Yeah, I thought the article was a really nice example of the collaboration and action and where this can take us. It's good.
Moving on then, what future directions from this forum were you guys able to discern or divine? Where do you think environmental histories of wildlife might be going from here?
I like the idea of blending wildlife history with more human history. The Beeler's article in particular, the idea that we are, in fact, spending a lot more time than we suspect than we would judge with sort of the Wildlife in America book. We're spending mm-hmm. a lot more time with wildlife on a regular basis than perhaps we think we are. And there's a lot of history to be done, I think, with this sort of blending of shared space rather than the tendency to think about wildlife in refuges and apart from humanity mm-hmm. in a wilderness. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of wild animals or untamed animals sharing histories with humans in very sort of material ways. I think that's a direction of I could see a few of these authors going.
I thought Etienne Benson's discussion about ideas about wildlife or animals before the sort of managerial ethos that begins in the 1930s, or before then, but thinking about human-animal relationship before it became the purview of experts, I think there's a lot of fruitful room for inquiry there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to reference the Benson article also, I mentioned earlier that was sort of my, the article that helped bring a lot of the other articles together for me. I would, sort of reading the collection as a whole and against the grain, I'd say that a possible direction to take these is more cultural studies about the cultural and material place of wildlife in national identities and national development. I thought with the referencing throughout a number of the articles that pieces involving that implied the frontier, you know, that animals, wildlife was intrinsically wrapped up in a sort of American culture, an America's history of development. Mm-hmm. I thought that this would be a way to, by taking that idea of wildlife and unpacking the difference between wild life as two words and wildlife as one word as we know today. To read that back through, Andrew, we were mentioning earlier, most animals have state animals, state birds. Mm-hmm.
They're emblematic.
Of animals are emblematic or valorized and things. And this is myself as sort of a landscape historian interested in culture a lot. This could be gone back to unpack a lot of things in culture and, and materially too, relationships.
Because these essays are very American. I think they all take a very American perspective on the importance of separating and having separate spaces for wildlife in wild areas apart from our civilization where most of human life takes place. And I wonder whether starting to critically analyze the good that conservation represents or the good of keeping wildlife separate, that is that not actually maybe in the long run undermining? Is it part of that declensionist narrative of from the get-go separating out wildlife from humanity, of creating that binary, even if it's one, something we explore as historians, is that not also something that has created all sorts of confusion and complications in this declensionist narrative that wildlife in America gets at it starting in 1959?
That's true. I mean, this is the forum is very explicitly North American or American. But I wonder if they had a participant who does European environmental history, if there might have been a different perspective. Or would have been nice to see a bit of a discussion of wildlife as a North American idea. But the meaning is not the same elsewhere.
It sort of runs through a few. There's a few. The one, goodness, I can't remember the name now, the one about habitat.
Yeah.
They were saying how the idea of habitat was closely linked up with ecology in a particular way in the United States. And I think that there's traces of it elsewhere too. Well, I mean, especially say the one about bears, Davy Crockett,
and Lewis Warren outlines very explicitly how this is an American idea that's evolved over time.
And I just wondered if they had had participants from say Europe or Asia, or, well, maybe Australia would be the same sort of story as a colonial society. If they would be a bit more dubious about the utility of the term wildlife, is it far more of like a North American idea, to be generous, rather than just an American one?
Just the trouble with wildlife that we're talking about.
And how might European connotations of wildlife really differ from ours in that sense of scarcity versus relative abundance in North America, and the distance of people's direct experience with wildlife in many European places. So how might that change a forum on wildlife that would have involved European historians?
More of an embedded perspective rather than a separated.
Perhaps, I also thought there's a definite, in the trajectory of these articles here, there's a definite push towards looking at animals that are more alien to humans, less anthropomorphic, and what might that tell us about, you know, cultural assumptions of, or you know, the ways that animals have been likable to us in various ways because of how close they might resemble our intelligence or our appearance or the kind of moral values we've attached to animals over time. And looking at things like rats and sharks, where that morality becomes quite difficult to discuss. I think there's some good direction there.
So is it time for a different term then? Is because articles here that are fish, perhaps should be considered wildlife. Urban animals like rats perhaps should be considered wildlife. I think it's perhaps even implied in the one about rats that the lice and things and fleas that transmit diseases between people and rats living in close proximity could be considered wildlife too. At that point, is it like, well, this term really needs revision rather than opening it up to more and more types of familiar, charismatic, uncharismatic animals? Maybe it's suggesting that the term isn't that helpful.
Maybe it's kind of a relic in thinking about charismatic animals as defined as wildlife in our historical understanding of the term. And maybe we need to think more just about animal species broadly.
You can learn some interesting things about the history of the idea of wildlife by looking at the histories of uncharismatic animals. And I think it's a little bit analogous to Alan McEachern's book on Atlantic Canadian National Parks and the struggle that park administrators had with trying to find park-like places in Atlantic Canada, places that looked like wilderness when the idea of wilderness in the early 20th century was so fixed on Western Rocky Mountain landscapes. So similarly for uncharismatic animals like fish or sharks or rats, we can begin to understand what came to define wildlife was actually very specific species of animals. Is it four-legged ungulates? Is that what wildlife is?
And those fish that offered a good fight, those fish that you know, yeah, gave you a workout and reeling them in.
Right, for sportsmen, yeah.
Yeah, for sportsmen that had some sort of human characteristic of bravery or
so this is where I might push back a bit, because I think there are probably a lot more Americans than Wadewitz is giving credit for that probably love fish. Love fishing fish, like the Hemingway kind of battle with the fish.
Yeah.
The fly fisherman who loves, like, waist deep in the stream, sort of communing with the fish in the stream.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that there is, I think, a lot more romantic feelings towards fish than maybe we're giving the credit
towards
for.
Certain fish species.
Towards certain
ones. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think
the
so.
The bottom feeders.
That moment of hesitation before you bonk the fish over the head, right? Yeah. Or if it's a catch and release kind of scenario where you're having this moment of communion.
People's
first
interaction with wildlife in a lot of cases is catching a fish as like a 6-year-old or something like that, right? I think there's something about the water habitat, though, that is really alien to people. The thinking about what goes on under the surface of the water, that fish, yeah, they don't look like people, but we also can't see very easily what they're up to either. Same thing with, like, insects, too, right? I mean, apart from E.O. Wilson, I can't think of a lot of people who are doing much interesting stuff to help humans think about insects in really meaningful and interesting ways.
I think there is a literature that's developing there, but yeah. It faces all sorts of challenges with source materials and other things. Yeah.
Humans don't think of themselves as competing for habitat with fish and bugs and often birds, perhaps in some ways. It's those animals on the ground that you can eat or be eaten by in some instances that are traditionally qualify as under the label wildlife.
But the collection of essays definitely got me thinking about the potential for writing about wildlife histories or animal histories that incorporate histories of habitat change. And how do you do that if you're going to write about particular species or sets of species? How do you also talk about the environments in which they live?
Yeah, how do you talk about place? And if you're covering the history of a species that occupies multiple places across a landscape, how would you meaningfully incorporate histories of habitat change?
The web of life, the interaction that species have with one another, the way that they sort of work together in a way to create habitat or to create the conditions and instincts that we give. You know, the shark doesn't exist in a vacuum. He exists because of the way other fish respond to him, the other species in the ocean.
But that's what's encouraging about that idea, that I think that's the space that environmental historians can fill. Right, that we don't study just animal species, individual species, but we study the interactions between animals and the interactions between animals and their environments.
But that's a complex challenge,
yeah.
Documenting the history of the web of life.
Well, I think that's a pretty good place to stop there. It goes without saying that these environmental history forum article collections stimulate a lot of discussion and debate, and hopefully listeners, if you haven't already read this forum, it's in the July 2011 issue of Environmental History. I want to thank you all for sitting down and talking a little bit about it. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Andrew. And thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thanks.
Starting next month, Nature's Past subscribers will get some bonus content in their podcast feed. While our podcast covers research in the fields of environmental history and historical geography in Canada, it's yet to explore the work of scholars in the field of environmental studies. In order to address this, two graduate students from York University's Faculty of Environmental Studies, Amanda DiBattista and Andrew Mark, have produced a special podcast series to profile the work of environmental studies scholars. Their series is called Coherence, and listeners can read all about it on their website at niche-canada.org/coherence, which is spelled C-O-H-E-A-R-E-N-C-E. And we'll link to that site on our show notes page. But to find out more right now, I spoke with Amanda and Andrew.
My name is Amanda DiBattista. I'm a PhD student in the Faculty of Environmental Studies, and I am the co-producer of Coherence.
And I'm also a PhD student at the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University, and the other co-producer of Coherence.
Well, thanks for joining me and coming here and telling us a little bit about your project. So why don't we just start off and let listeners know what Coherence is.
Right. So basically, we decided to put together a podcast that features content from the research that's happening within our faculty and sort of create a space for networking and learning about the disparate sorts of fields that we have going on.
And Niche seemed to be a really good place to sort of start that conversation, and Nature's Past has been a really wonderful collaborator, I think, because the Faculty of Environmental Studies here at York is really interesting in that we've got planners and we've got activists and we've got educators and we've sort of got this wild range of people. So putting together a podcast about culture, history, and environment has been a splendid sort of thing to do. It's been a lot of fun.
And it's a new way in which these ideas that are circulating sort of recombine and reconfigure.
This will be a really interesting experience for listeners, because typically Niche is focused on environmental history and historical geography, but we haven't brought in a lot of content from environmental studies, so this sounds like it's going to be a great opportunity to introduce that research to the broader community of historians and historical geographers. So how did the project come about? Where did you guys get this idea? What were the origins?
I suppose the idea came to me first because of the long commute to York, and I can distinctly remember...
This is the birth of all podcasts at York University.
Exactly, the commute. But I do remember putting a call out to my friends and saying, well, what are your favorite podcasts? And just listening to them at the same time as starting my my MA in music, and here I was commuting up to York. It was an hour long at least each way. And I was exposed to This American Life and eventually Radiolab and Dan Savage, and the theory began to reconfigure, as I said before, recombine with what I was listening to. And I realized it was this kind of incredible medium. So I was really looking for an opportunity to get this going at our faculty. And by chance, Kate Sandilands noticed that Colin Coates was doing a conference on Hornby Island, which is where I'm doing my fieldwork and dissertation. And in that same newsletter where this conference was announced, there was also the pitch for Niche projects. And I realized around that time, I did a little searching on it, and I found Nature's Past. And I went, oh my gosh, they've already got a podcast, and maybe we could do something like this, or maybe we could team up, or whatever, and I wrote you that first email. Meanwhile, in getting realistic about what it would take to create a podcast, I realized I needed somebody who had writing skills. And so that's when I contacted Amanda, who was in my cohort.
Yeah, so we had already been friends and worked together on other, I think, small projects. And Andrew called me up and was like, hey, you want to do a podcast? I was like, a what? Sure, I guess. And I think it's been a really great collaboration so far, because Andrew's got all the technical skills and the sound theory skills and whatnot. And my focus in my work is often, for the most part, on creative writing and narrative. So we have this really interesting exchange, because we have to overcome, you know, the challenges of podcasting, which are 2-3 hour long interviews, making those sort of palatable in a podcast format. And I think looking at all of the information and all the material we've collected as a story, and trying to focus the podcast themselves on creating this really interesting narrative, and then adding high quality sound editing has been our focus, and has been both challenging and extremely interesting.
So now, over a year later, we've got a series.
Yep.
Listeners can expect a monthly rollout of episodes. Mm-hmm. But what can they look forward to? What are the kind of topics in environmental studies that you cover on Coherence?
Okay. Well, we'll be starting with a two-part episode on melancholy and mourning. So we'll look at Freudian theory and environmental loss, and how to grieve environmental disasters, or how people are grieving environmental disasters. And that seems to be a really... that one's a really interesting episode. It's really full of theory, but also these really candid discussions about grief and about loss, and about how to maybe mourn things that aren't necessarily always mournable. We've got an episode on food, which is delightful.
Yeah.
We will have an episode that we collected material from the Green World's Green Words Conference. And we focus on politics and literature in environmental studies. Got one on art. Mm-hmm. And we've got an episode on protest and resistance, in which we'll focus on the G20 and some... we're going to mix theory about protest and resistance with some really personal, honest stories from people who experienced the G20 firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say I'm pretty excited to hear the first episode, and listeners can expect to get the first episode in their podcast feed starting next episode, or next month in February. Amanda and Andrew, I want to thank you for telling us a little bit about Coherence, and thank you for putting together this project.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for having us.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Jennifer Bunnell, Ben Bradley, Andrew Watson, Andrew Mark, Amanda DiPatista, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you've got ideas for a new episode, or you want to send me some feedback about this episode, you can contact me through my website, seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, or you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another episode of Nature's Past.